Hey y'all, I'm Carrie.
Hello, I'm Ashley.
And this is Monstrous.
Welcome, guys.
So we're back from our hiatus. It's been a long few weeks, but we're back. And hopefully everyone likes what we've changed. We have basically given the podcast a facelift, and we'll continue to make adjustments and changes as we go and our listener base grows. So before we dive into the case today, we have some housekeeping to get out of the way first.
Okay.
So obviously from the intro, Ashley is my new full-time co-host.
Hello, everyone.
And that's going to be fun because, Ashley, you're not into true crime, scary, or spooky stuff like I am at all. So it'll be fun.
I am. It's just to an extent, but it will be fun.
As I'm sure everyone noticed, we have new artwork and new music. We both feel that the music and the artwork fit the podcast a little bit better than what we had before. And then lastly, our release days have changed as well. Starting today, we will be releasing our regular full-length episodes bi-weekly on Mondays. This schedule fits both Ashley and I right now, and it allows us to dive into each case. And it lets us provide all available information out there, so that way we can give you guys a good episode to start your week off right. On our off weeks, we may do like a mini-sode or like a bonus episode once a month, still details that we're working out. So once we get that figured out, we of course will let everyone know.
We definitely will.
Our episode frequency, the days they are released, all of that will be adjusted and changed as we need to, as the podcast grows and we get more listeners. Any of those updates, we will of course announce here, but they can also be found on our Facebook page as well. So I believe that's all of the housekeeping we have today, unless you have anything else to add, Ashley.
Nope, that would do it. Happy to be with you guys.
We're happy to have you full time. It'll be fun.
It is going to be fun.
Okay, so let's get into today's case then.
So this episode is going to be our first two-parter episode.
Okay.
Our case this week has a crime scene that shook a tight-knit community. Happening only 2 months after the Titanic sunk, this horrific, gruesome crime scene knocked the historic sinking from the front page of all the newspapers. It divided the population and left a cultural and economic stain on the town forever. It involved a murder investigation that spanned over nearly 10 years, multiple grand jury hearings, a slander suit, two murder trials, countless minor litigations, and it both made and broke political careers.
Century-old unsolved axe murder. 8 people hacked to death.
And it all happened in a little town of Villisca, Iowa.
Some say it's one of the most haunted houses in the United States.
Century-old unsolved axe murder.
An entire family and 2 of their friends to death as they slept.
Their skulls crushed beyond recognition.
To this day, the case remains unsolved.
The murder suspects include a power-hungry politician with a grudge, a sexually perverted preacher, and a mysterious killer who had struck before.
And many believe the home where the murders took place is now haunted.
If ever a house had reason to be haunted, this would be it.
In this picturesque small Iowa town, on a warm, peaceful summer night, 8 unsuspecting sleeping victims were bludgeoned to death. Despite a manhunt that spanned across the nation, multiple suspects and 2 trials, the murders remain unsolved, even to today. This case is one about America's most infamous, tragic, perplexing, and only octuple axe murder. It is the worst mass murder that the state of Iowa has ever seen, and the most heinous crime as a whole in the state's entire history. So this year marked 112 years since a family of six and their two visitors were bludgeoned to death in their sleep inside a home in a small southwest Iowa town.
Okay.
And even still, over a century later, this case is an enduring and unsettling enigma in America's criminal past and still draws in the wonder of what happened that late summer night. So this week, we are going back to the year 1912. The year this small, quiet town was shaken to its core and forever changed. This is the unsolved murders and subsequent haunting of the Villisca Axe Murder House, which you don't know anything about, and I can't believe you're from Iowa. I'm from Iowa, and I know about it. So it's crazy to me. You had no idea what I was talking about whenever I was like, oh, have you heard of this?
No.
But you had a very sheltered life, so I guess that would explain it.
I was very sheltered. What are you talking about? Very sheltered. Very.
Okay. So first I'm going to tell you a little bit of history on the town itself. So, Villisca is the site of a Pulitzer Prize-winning photo that was ran in Life magazine. This photo featured Lieutenant Colonel Robert Moore, who was greeting his family at the depot after returning home from his service in Africa. I couldn't find this photo, so if anyone out there happens to have this magazine or a copy of this picture, we would love to share it with everyone. But it was like a big picture. It won the Pulitzer Prize, and it brought a lot of attention to the town. So Villisca today is located in the exact same place it was in 1912, obviously. But the area around it is vastly different. It is in what is known as Montgomery County. Montgomery County is about 100 miles southwest of Des Moines. It's settled between two rivers that are surrounded by the rolling hills and the farmland of southwest Iowa. Which, honestly, anyone that knows Iowa, that's pretty much all Iowa is.
Yes.
Flat farmland. Nothing but corn for miles. So the town began as a settlement known as the Forks. This area had only two stores and a handful of homes in 1861. This was the year before the town became a town. So in the same year, the town was selected as a coveted spot along the Chicago, Burlington, and Quincy Railroad line. Years following this, the Civil War slowed down the construction of the railroads. Despite the fact that the town had just been awarded a position along the railroad, and the Civil War slowing it down, the railroad still made the town flourish. It became a retail and agricultural trade hotspot. In 1867, the train line had finally been complete and it had reached Villisca, and the town grew from there. The town was established in 1872 and has a current population as of today of 1,171 residents. So it's like definition tiny town. Everybody knows everybody and everybody's business.
Huh.
It's like a town that I grew up in where you may not know this person, but the person knows you for sure.
Yeah, screw that.
So the town was plated by one of the railroad workers. His name was D.N. Smith. He actually named the town Villisca. I wanted to know why he chose the name Villisca. Like, what kind of name is that? Well,
that is kind of a different name.
Exactly. And that's why I was like, why? Of all the names you could pick, like, most founders picked their name and named the town after themselves or someone they knew. But why Villisca? So I looked into it. The founder had actually used a word from the Sac and Fox Indian tribe, who were apparently native to the Villisca area.
Huh.
When he heard them talking of the area, he believed that they were saying Villisca. But they were actually saying Walliska. So the spelling and pronunciation of the name is wrong. Because the founder couldn't fully understand the natives of the region. He misunderstood what they were saying. He chose the name because he believed the word Walliska meant pretty place. But he was extremely wrong. When the Sac and Fox natives called the area Walliska, they weren't saying it was a pretty place. They were saying it was evil. Walliska actually means an evil spirit or Satan.
That's different.
So talk about a massive miscommunication and misunderstanding of a word.
For sure.
So, by the time the new century rolled around, Villisca was booming. It now housed a population of 2,500 residents. The town had a variety of retail stores, restaurants, a movie theater, and two large churches. The town of Villisca had a large and very proud military history. And even to today, it still does. This history had begun in 1912, when the construction of Iowa's only publicly funded and longest running armory was built. In this same year, so 1912, the town was named one of the finest towns in the state by Iowa's Touring Atlas. It was described as a perfectly picturesque town filled with Victorian homes and tree-lined streets. Awake the boom of the railroad, the house at 508 East 2nd Street was built in 1868. It was built on lot number 310 for a local man named George Loomis. The home almost mirrored the others surrounding it. It was about 600 square feet. It included two bedrooms, a parlor, a downstairs sewing room, a kitchen, and an outhouse. Following the construction of the home, Loomis had built a barn next to the house. Then, in 1903, the home was put on the market and sold to Josiah Morton, which is the family in our case. This family consisted of Josiah, his wife Sarah, and their four children. Herman, who was the eldest at 11 years old, Catherine, who was 10, Boyd, who was 7, and Paul, who was the baby at 5 years old. How the two more adults met isn't known, or at least I couldn't find it, but I do know that Josiah Moore and Sarah Montgomery got married on December 6th of 1899 at Sarah's parents' home. Josiah, just like most people who lived in Villisca at the time, came from a very big family. Along with his parents, he grew up alongside six of his eight living siblings. The Moore family were a family that had very deep roots within their community. At the time, Josiah Moore was 34 years old. He was one of Villisca's most prominent businessmen who had secured a franchise of the continuously growing John Deere Company. Before this, he worked for 9 years for Frank Jones, who was a hardware and agriculture store owner, as well as a state politician. Frank Jones was the House Assemblyman for the state of Iowa from 1904 to 1907, and then went to become the Iowa State Senate from 1913 to 1915.
So why in a couple-year gap?
Well, I think the Senates are elected every year, I believe. Oh. But I could be wrong. I'm not really into politics, so I'm not really sure. So if anybody knows, please let us know that. So after leaving Frank Jones's hardware and agriculture store, Josiah opened up his own store right across the street from Frank Jones. The very store that he once worked at was now the competition. So along with the Moore family, our case today also involves two little neighbor girls, Lena and Ina Stillinger, who were 12 and 8 respectively. The Stillinger girls were the daughters of yet another prominent man in the town. Their father was a wealthy farmer who lived on the edge of town, southeast of Villisca, about 7 miles from the Moore home, to be exact. Now it's going to get a little rough.
All right, let's hear it.
So here's where I'm going to put in a trigger warning and a listener discretion. Obviously, we have listener discretion for all of our episodes, but this one gets a little rough and it does involve children. So the night of June 9th, Josiah called the Stillinger house and asked if the Stillinger girl's older sister, Blanche, if their two younger sisters could stay and attend a church function. They had been there for the day. They were going to the church function with the Moore family. And Josiah didn't want the two young girls walking home in the dark by themselves. Blanche had said yes. She didn't see why that would be a problem. So the family and the two girls walked to their local Presbyterian church for a program that the church was holding for the children. Following this event, the family and their two guests returned to the Moore home around 10 p.m. Their home was a 5-minute walk from the church. As I described before, the Moore home was small, and so they had to make room for their overnight guests. Sarah and Josiah slept in their master bedroom, obviously. They had set up the parlor room downstairs as a bedroom for the Stillinger sisters to sleep in. Catherine, their only daughter, had her own room, while her brothers slept in the room next door to the master bedroom. What the family and their guests did once they arrived home isn't for sure known, obviously, but we could all assume that because it was late, that most likely they ate dinner and headed to bed shortly after arriving back to the house. Following what seemed to be like a peaceful Sunday summer night was a tragedy that turned this quiet town upside down, and it would never be the same as it was before. Sometime after midnight, someone who either entered the Moore home after everyone had fallen asleep or had been laying in wait attacked and bludgeoned everyone in their sleep. The family was discovered the next morning after Josiah did not answer the phone from his clerk and after neighbors became concerned when they didn't see the family outside doing their normal daily chores. This led them to call relatives of the Moore family. Mary Peck, who was the Moore's closest neighbor, went outside about 5 a.m. just as the sun was rising. By the time 6 a.m. hit, she realized that the Moore family was not up and doing their daily chores. This was odd to her because the family was normally a boisterous family, especially since it was a Monday morning and the kids were expected to be at school that day. So by 7 a.m., she became extremely concerned. The family horses were restless, and along with the other animals, the horses had not yet been fed. So she went over and knocked on the door, but no one answered. She went on to attempt to peek inside the windows to see if she could see what was going on, but all the curtains were closed, which was also not normal. She tried to open both the front and back doors, and to her shock, they were locked. So she knew right away something wasn't right. She was disturbed by how quiet and still the home was, so she called Josiah's brother, Ross. She had spoke to his wife. She wanted to know, was the family sick, or had Josiah's father fallen ill himself? Well, Ross wasn't home. Mary then called the store that Ross owned, but he wasn't there either. About 8:15, Mary had finally reached Ross, who arrived at the Moore home. Ross couldn't just walk into the home either because the doors were locked, which was odd to both of them because during this time, Villisca was a town where you didn't lock your doors at night or when you left for the day. It was safe up until this summer night. Luckily, though, he had a key to the home and let himself in. At first, he saw nothing wrong with the home, but that quickly changed. Ross went into the first floor bedroom and saw there was a sheet pulled over the bed, and he could tell there was something under it. Once he got closer to the bed, he could smell a mixture of copper and blood. He pulled the sheet back, and there he found the Stillinger sisters. Ross went running from the house and told Mary to call the town marshal to call everyone. One of the Moore family workers, Ed Seeley, had arrived at this exact moment to tend to the family livestock. Ross had told him not to bother with it, that, quote, something terrible has happened here. The town marshal, Henry Horton, arrived shortly after Ed Seeley had and went into the Moore home to investigate. A few moments later, Horton appeared from inside the house. He looked at Josiah's brother, Mary, and Ed and said, quote, somebody was murdered in every bed.
So they are all murdered?
Yep. All eight of them.
Damn.
The killer, or killers, because we don't know if it was one or more than one, had found an axe that was located in the family's backyard and used that to bludgeon all eight victims. So, experts and researchers now believe that based off the seam that Josiah was attacked first, then Sarah, like each of the other victims, Sarah was only hit with the blunt end of the axe, so like the handle.
Yeah.
While Josiah seemed to be hit with both ends. So after the parents were dead, the killer went into the adjacent room and proceeded one room at a time to kill all four of the Moore children. Then, from there, moved downstairs to where the Stillinger sisters were and killed them as well. Then, as if it's not horrific enough, the murderer went back upstairs and savagely attacked Josiah and Sarah Moore again. This is known because there was a shoe next to their bed that had been filled with blood after the first attack. When the killer went back, it had been knocked over. So the blood that was in the shoe had spilled out.
Weird.
So, it's obviously hard to count the exact marks on an attack like this, due to a lot of times there's crossover in the markings and the damage that it causes, obviously. What is known is that Josiah had received around 30 chops to his body and face, and possibly more.
That's quite a lot.
Yeah. The other family members, I couldn't find where it says around how many hits they received.
Yeah. But why so many just on that one person?
Nobody knows. I think he was the primary target.
I mean, it sounds like it.
Or it could have been that he was more of a threat, and so maybe the killer wanted to make sure he was dead. I don't know. Nobody really knows. There's a lot of theories and speculation out there, and because it happened so long ago, there's no way to really know. Yeah. So each member of the family, along with the two guests, were practically unidentifiable because of the brutality that was unleashed. The only reason why they knew who they were is because they knew whose house it was.
I mean, that's a good thing.
There was so much force with each swing that there were marks left in the ceiling and on the walls from where the axe had hit as the murderer drew back to take another hit on the unsuspecting victim. So every time the killer pulled back, like to get ready to hit again, like as if, you know, you're chopping wood.
Yeah.
The head of the axe hit the ceiling or the wall and left marks in it. The killer used so much force.
Damn.
And axes are not light. Like, they're heavy.
They are.
So to use that much force that you actually hit and leave markings in the ceiling says a lot. He's a very, very angry person.
Very angry.
So, following the brutal murders, the killer then decided to walk around the house. He covered each victim with a piece of cloth or clothing The mirrors and windows had been covered, which this was common practice during the time because, you know, they used their homes as like their funeral parlors. So during the wakes and funerals, they would cover mirrors and windows out of, you know, like respect, things like that for the dead. So it's really not known if this was done before or after the killings happened.
It had to have been like after.
That's what I think. That's what a lot of people think, is that he did it after. But he could have done it before also, so that way nobody could see into the windows and see what was going on. And he could have covered the mirrors so he didn't see himself doing what he was doing.
True.
That's why nobody knows when it happened, because it could really go either way. So, after covering each victim, and then, you know, the windows and the mirrors, he returned to the downstairs bedroom, where he left the axe leaning up against a wall. He then went into the kitchen area, washed his hands in a pail of water, made himself some food, some bread and beans, and then he left, locking the door with a key behind him at what is believed to be shortly before 5 a.m. Sometime after 8:40 a.m., Town Central Phone Center issued an all-call alert informing everyone of the murders, which, let me just say, that's your first mess up right there. You're just drawing the attention. Within minutes of the call, the entire home and scene became an out-of-control, full-blown spectacle and turned this already hard-to-solve case into an impossible one. Upwards of 100 people showed up at the Morgue home crime scene and trampled through the entire crime scene, all with the bodies of all 8 victims still in the place where they were slain. So you got, like, you know, 100 plus people just tramping through the crime scene while all the victims still lay in their beds.
And that shouldn't ever happen.
No, it shouldn't have. Like, you just messed up. Which, I mean, in their defense, it was, you know, 1912. Back then, they didn't know that doing this is going to compromise the entire crime scene. Because what we have now, they didn't have then. You know what I mean? Like, they didn't know that. So, hindsight is 2020. I feel like if that would have never happened, it would have been solved. But they didn't know any better. So, and the crime scene itself, well, that was a macabre of brutality. It contained shattered skulls, pools of blood, and many peculiar details. Due to the brutality and the random pieces of skull that was found everywhere, all of the evidence, etc., each of these 100 spectators made all of this chaos so much worse. A local druggist whose hobby was photography had shown up to take photos of the scene. But, thankfully, he was dismissed and told that taking the photos would be, quote, too ghoulish. You think about that now, and they take pictures of crime scenes all the time.
Yeah.
Like, the normal thing now. The town marshal, Hank Horton, he let some of the locals handle the murder weapon.
And that's just,
Yeah, like, here you go. You can hold it. Just pass it around.
It's like, kind of like no respect for the family, you know?
Exactly. To make that worse, some of the townspeople took pieces of Josiah's skull as a souvenir before they were ushered out of the house.
That's just weird.
Like, oh, here's a piece of his skull. I'm just going to take that home and put that on my mantle. Like,
no, thank you.
Right, exactly. So the county coroner, Dr. Lindquist, had arrived on scene at around 9 a.m. After first viewing the scene, he met with Horton, who was not only the town marshal, but he had also been the town watchman that Sunday night. He had also met with Sheriff Orion Jackson to review the information that they had already collected. Upon seeing the condition of the crime scene. Dr. Lindquist was completely appalled by the flow of people that had been allowed to walk through it, touch things, and just be there in general. So he urged the sheriff to call in the National Guard to secure the scene, which thankfully, after being told by a doctor to do so, the sheriff did just that. The state's armor was located right there in Villisca. So by 10:30 a.m., the National Guard had secured the perimeter around the home. Everyone that needed to be there had finally arrived, and the scene had finally been secured over 3 hours after the bodies had been discovered. Now, the investigation had officially begun, and in those first few hours, there was a lot discovered within the crime scene itself. The killer had left behind a few bizarre things. A 4-pound slab of bacon was found leaning against a wall next to the axe. The killer had covered every window, mirror, and glass pane around the house, as I said before. Officials found a plate of uneaten food, so he made the food but didn't eat it, and a bowl of bloody water inside the kitchen, but nothing else in the house had been disturbed. Because of this, they had been able to rule out a burglary as a motive, or even a robbery gone wrong. Because not only was nothing not disturbed inside the house, they had found Josiah's wallet with cash inside and other valuable things still inside the home in plain sight. It was found that the Stillinger girls' bodies had been moved after they had been killed. This is kind of rough, this portion of it. Ina was found on her stomach with her butt in the air. Lena had been moved and her undergarments had been removed. Her legs had been positioned in a way to reveal her genital area. But despite the posing and the lack of undergarments, there was no evidence that either girl had been sexually assaulted. So the killer had moved them and posed them just for a wow factor, basically.
And that's...
Yeah. Just to make it so much worse than it already is. He just decided, let's pose these young girls in a provocative manner to make them believe that it was one thing, not what it actually was.
Which is crazy.
Yeah, I mean, thankfully, they weren't sexually assaulted. That's good. But the fact that they were posed in the way they were, it's like, why would you do that anyway? You're just making yourself look even worse. So, inside the barn, investigators have found an imprint in the hay next to a knot hole. Which, do you know what a knot hole is?
No.
Okay, a knot hole is like, it's like a little hole in the side of the barn, basically.
Okay.
They believe that the killer had hid here and watched the family for some time. I'm fucking echoing again. So finding this knot hole led the investigators to believe that the killer had hid here and watched the family for some time in order to learn their habits and routines. Two smoked cigarettes were found inside the attic, which also led investigators to believe that the murderer may have entered the home through a window or unlocked door and hid until the family had returned from church and were all asleep.
Person that murdered them knew the schedule.
Yeah, that's what it looked like to investigators at the time, because they found an imprint in the hay as if somebody had been laying on the hay for a long period of time. And then the hole in the side of the barn was just big enough to see through and was in a spot where you could see the family home from there. And then two smoked cigarettes being in the attic, made them believe that the killer had hid in the attic for a little bit of time, lying in wait for them. But that's the only evidence that the killer had planned. That's why they don't know. Was it a thing of opportunity, or was it someone who knew the family who had targeted them?
I want to say it was somebody that knew the family.
That's what most people think. There's several suspects, which we're going to get into all those. And then you can tell me which one you think it is. So, aside from these two things, the killer had also left behind a few curious pieces of evidence, aside from what I have already stated. Upstairs, they found a gas lamp with its chimney removed and its wick turned down so far that it barely gave off any light. So you know what the chimney part of a gas lamp is, right?
Yeah.
Okay. A lot of people don't know because they don't use gas lamps anymore.
My mom has a collection of them.
Oh, okay. So for anyone that does not know, obviously a gas lamp is ran off gas. And the chimney is like the glass piece that goes around the flame. So when they found it, that piece had been taken off. And then on gas lamps, it has like a little knob that you can turn left and right. One way, if I remember correctly, left turns it up higher and right turns it down low. But I might have that backwards. It might be the other way around. But the wick, it was turned down so low. And what that means is that that knob tells the lamp how much gas to put onto the wick. The more gas it has, the brighter the flame is. But was turned down so low that it barely gave off any light. Just enough for you to be able to see where you're walking, and that's it. Which anyone that knows a gas lamp or has ever used a gas lamp, you're not going to just barely have it lit.
Yeah.
On top of that, a fragment of a keychain that did not belong to anyone in the Moore family was found downstairs. So two things that can be found distinctly to the killer. Following the initial walkthrough of the crime scene and after talking with the detectives, Dr. Lindquist had called in members of the coroner's jury, which is not something that they do anymore. Could you imagine being on a coroner's jury? So this jury gathered at the home in the late afternoon on Monday, June 10th. But it was hours before they had actually showed up to view the bodies. So we called up, hey, you know, we need to gather at this home for a coroner's jury. And it was hours after that phone call before they ever actually showed up. Like in 1912, people took their sweet ass time to do shit. So the family and the two girls were obviously taken away for an autopsy. It took 12 hours from the time they were discovered for Lindquist to call the county attorney, who then had to call the undertaker to remove them. 12 hours.
Damn.
Yeah. The fire station in Villisca had been set up as a temporary morgue. And by the time the bodies had been transported there, it was nearly 2 a.m. Tuesday morning. So by the time they had reached their temporary morgue for their autopsies, it was 24 hours after the victims were brutally murdered in their sleep. It took 24 hours for them to finally be taken away from the home that they had been killed inside. Which is just absolutely crazy to me. 24 hours to move them. Like, so much evidence is lost at that point.
Like, so much.
Because it's summer. You know they don't have central AC. It's June, so it's hot. So much has changed on these bodies in the last 24 hours.
Oh, like for
that, sure. That just fucked your shit up right there. So based on initial estimates, the doctor was able to give a time that he believed the murders had took place, which was somewhere between midnight and 2 a.m. on the morning of June 10th, 1912. The autopsies also revealed that each victim had died from severe head injuries, obviously. and that the only one to have appeared to have woken up during the entire thing was Lena, which was one of the Stillinger sisters. This was proved because Lena had a blood stain on her knees and what looked like defensive wounds on her arm. So out of all eight victims, she's the only one that is known to have woken up.
Imagine, though, being a kid and waking up and seeing that, you know?
Right, exactly. She was 12, that's what I thought. She just this 12-year-old little girl waking up in the middle of the night, having to fight for her life. And because she's a 12-year-old little girl, she couldn't fight him. So it's that fact makes the whole thing just so much more worse than it already is.
Oh, yeah.
So once the autopsy and the reconstruction of the night's events was complete, the investigation had moved on to gather statements from neighbors, which this didn't really result in much. The neighbors stated that they didn't hear any cries coming from the Moore home that night, and they didn't see anything that would cause them any kind of concern. So many people then and now wonder how someone could have maneuvered in such a compact, creaky farmhouse without waking anyone up. So at the time of the murders, the house was only about 44 years old. And back then, homes were built stronger than they are now. So Ashley, both of our homes were built in the 1900s. So you and I both know how homes in this era were built.
Yeah.
They're, you know, this home is smaller than what ours are. It's a very compact home. But even though it's smaller, they still have, you know, the wood floors, the wood finishings throughout on the doorways and the windows and, you know, things like that. So it's built stronger and more sturdy, which means the floors tend to creak. So even though the house was only 44 years old, it still would have had the hardwood floors. The vents would have been connected to one another. So, which means one room, you could talk into a vent and someone in a completely different room is going to hear your voice through the vent. Are your vents connected like that? Or do they redo them?
Oh, there we get it.
Oh, okay. Ours are still connected. It was so funny whenever the boys figured that out. It was hilarious.
Really?
Logan would get in trouble and be sent to his room. Dax would be downstairs in the basement, and they'd be talking to each other through the vents. Mm. Yep. Logan would be trying to tell Dax on how to play a video game. Meanwhile, he's supposed to be in his room in trouble. Mm. Yeah. But unless the vents are redone, like yours were, houses built in the 1900s had ventilation systems like that, where it was all connected together. So this house most likely had all of those features because it's 44 years old. They're not redoing anything at that point. So all of those things really makes it wonder how in the world did the killer get through the house and cause all of this brutality without anyone waking up? And at the time, newspapers had a theory for it. They suggested that the killer had somehow placed some kind of sedative inside the family's milk or cocoa. But nobody knows for sure because the toxicology reports that we have now, which would have tested for something like that in a case like this, weren't a part of routine autopsies in 1912. So we'll never know if the killer had placed some kind of sedative in the family's. But, I mean, it would make sense that they had been sedated, and that's why no one woke up. It would also make sense for why no one heard scream.
It's hard telling.
Yeah, but it's one of those things that nobody will ever know. So following the limited investigation on June 9th, the coroner held an inquest on the murders. So an inquest and a coroner's jury are two different things. So the inquest listed 14 witnesses that had been called to testify before the coroner's jury. So everyone that had testified before was brought back in front of a different group of people for an inquest. So according to murderhouse.com, the inquest stated the following about the testimonies. So everyone knows this was pulled directly from the website. So there's a lot of direct quotes throughout it. So the first witness they called was Mary Peckham, who, if you remember, was the Moore's next door neighbor.
Yeah.
Peckham had testified that she lived directly next door to the Moores, and she had seen them before they left for church on Saturday evening. She had, however, gone to bed at around 8 p.m., so she did not see when the family returned. According to her testimony, Peckham heard no noises from the house during the night. She was out in her yard hanging her weekly wash between 5 a.m. and 6 a.m. She noticed close to 7 a.m. that the house seemed unusually still. After attempting to wake the family and finding the doors locked, she let out their chickens and checked on the other livestock. Seeing that they were all still tied, she called the home of Ross Moore to ask if there was any reason that the family may not have come home. After speaking with Jessie, Ross Moore's wife, she then saw Ed Seeley, one of Josiah's employees, enter into the barn to feed the horses. Shortly after, Ross arrived and found a key to open the door. According to Peckham, she stayed on the porch while he looked in the kitchen and then opened the door to the downstairs bedroom. After seeing two bodies and blood-stained sheets, Ross immediately returned to the porch where Mary was waiting to inform her that something awful had happened and instructed her to call the sheriff. Peckham testified that the doors had been locked with a key and no key was in the lock on the inside of the door. So, like, from what she could see from inside, she couldn't see a key on the inside. So it didn't appear as though, you know, they had locked it from the inside of the house rather than the outside.
Right.
So next, they called Ed Seeley, who, like I said before, was a Moore family employee. So Ed Seeley had worked at Josiah's farm implement dealership. He arrived right after Josiah's brother. Seeley had testified that on Monday morning, June 10th, he had opened the store and received a telephone call from Ross. Ross Moore had asked Seeley if he knew where Josiah was, and he said no. Seeley called the elder Moore's home to see if he had gone to visit his father. Josiah's mother told him that he had not been there. Seeley then received a call from Mary Peckham, who asked him if Josiah was at the store and that the Moore's livestock needed tending to. Seeley then left the store and went to the Moore home where he fed the horses. After returning to the store, he received another call telling him to bring the marshal to the house quickly. According to Seeley's testimony, Ross and Peckham entered the house before he returned with the marshal, Hank Horton. When they arrived, they all re-entered the house together. After seeing blood on the bed in the downstairs bedroom, Seeley left the house. While waiting outside, he was met by Josiah's brother, Harry. When Marshall Horton came out of the house, he said either somebody was dead or had been killed in every bed. Which I just want to say that's the same thing.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure why it's worded that way, but whatever. At that time, the marshal had locked the house and left the keys with Mary Peckham, which he locks the house, but then lets everyone in the neighborhood trample through the crime scene. Why did you lock the house in the first place? That makes no sense.
No, it don't.
So he left and went to call the coroner and the sheriff. Seeley returned to the store to call the John Deere head office in Omaha to alert them of the news. Seeley returned to the house with his father after making the call to Omaha, but did not re-enter the house. When questioned at the inquest about possible enemies of Joe Moore, Seeley admitted that Joe had mentioned a brother-in-law that could have been a threat. Quote, he, Joe, says, I got a brother-in-law that don't like me. Said he would get even with me sometime. The brother-in-law that Moore was referring to was Sam Moyer. Seeley denied having any other information regarding anyone who would have wanted to murder the Moore family, and he was excused. The third witness was Dr. Cooper, who was the first physician to arrive on the scene. So, I know it's a shock, okay, that we're talking about another doctor besides Lindquist. Because before this testimony, I couldn't find any record that there was any doctor besides Dr. Lindquist. So, I'm not sure where this guy came from. So Cooper testified that he had called the Moore home at approximately 8:15 a.m. on June 10th. Marshall Horton entered his office and said, quote, come with me. When he asked why, Cooper said Horton appeared frightened and said, quote, Joe Moore and all his family were murdered in bed. Cooper accompanied Horton to the house and waited outside while Horton retrieved the keys from the Peckhams. When he returned, Cooper, Horton, another doctor named Hugh, I think that's how you say it, and the Presbyterian minister, Mr. Ewing, entered the home together. Which I just want to say, why do you need a minister? What's the minister going to do for you in the middle of a crime scene?
Who knows compared to back then to now?
Like, he's just going to be all up in the way. Like, praying over their bodies and shit. Sir, do that outside. You're in the way. You know what I mean? Like, I don't understand. But it's the 1900s, so.
Yeah.
So according to Cooper, the group stepped into the dining room and then into the first bedroom floor. Quote, all we could see was an arm of someone sticking from under the edge of the cover with the blood on the pillows. I went over and lifted the covers and saw what I supposed was a body, some entire stranger, and a mere child at the back of the bed. I did not recognize them at all. Neither did either any of the people. The others then that were with me, and we merely saw they were dead. And that there were only two in the bed, and then we stepped out into the park. It's kind of hard to read some of this because the way they talk throws me off. When they reached the top of the stairs, a lamp sat on the floor. Horton had moved the lamp out of their way, and they continued into the bedroom. Quote, the lamp was sitting at the foot of the bed in our way, so Hank set it to one side to allow us to pass. He further said, quote, Marshall Horton was ahead of me, and he walked around to the corner, to the left-hand side of the bed, and turned the cover back, and said, here is Joe. I merely glanced over there the first time as I came up, and I saw that Mr. and Mrs. Moore were both dead. From there, Cooper said he immediately went into the south room and left the others in the room with the parents. Quote, I do not know whether any of them come with me to the south room, but I left plenty of them in the north room. While I went to the south room, then we began to count the children. See what I mean? The way they talk, it's just, it messes me up so bad.
Yeah.
So when questioned about the condition of the bodies, Cooper had admitted that he did not touch the corpses. Quote, the bedding was pretty stiff at the head, and the blood and the brains on the pillow were, he paused and continued, quote, had contracted, as it does when killed. It will dry so that it was perfect jelly at that time, and blood clots were dry. He estimated that the victims had been dead for at least 5 to 6 hours at that point. So what he's talking about, have you ever heard of like when blood coagulates?
Mm-mm.
Okay, so when blood coagulates, it happens. So like if you cut your hand, right? And you get blood on your counter and you just leave it, like you don't clean it up immediately. Like, you know, people obviously do that. But if you were to just leave it, after so many hours, it starts to coagulate. And the longer it sits, the more it coagulates. So what that means is it's not really a serum, but that's the best way to describe it. It's like clear liquid stuff separates from the blood itself. So, like tomato sauce. You know, if you leave a small plate of tomato sauce, and after so long of it just sitting there, like it separates. You have the red thick stuff, and then around the outside you have like that clear yellowish liquid stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. That's what blood does. It's called coagulation. It's like a jelly-like serum. Basically, that's in your blood that separates from the blood cells. So when he's talking about it was like perfect jelly at that time, that's what he's talking about.
Oh.
Yeah. It took me a minute to think of what, like, a good example of what I was trying to describe.
That makes sense, though.
Because unless you know what it is or have seen it, it's hard to put it into words.
Right.
But that's what happens when your blood coagulates. It just separates from the liquid serum that's inside of it. So anyway, Cooper also testified that he had smelled no unusual or antiseptic odor in the house, and that it seemed that the faces of the victims had been covered after they were murdered. Quote, I saw no clothes sticking into any of the wounds. In my superficial examinations, neither did I see any clothing that had any holes in it. I mean, any of the sheets or pillows had nothing had a hole in it. So that means he killed them, then covered them up. So next they called Jesse Moore, Ross Moore's wife. So Josiah's sister-in-law. She testified that she had answered the phone when Peckham had called on the morning of June 10th to ask if anything had happened to C.C. Moore, who is Josiah's father. After that call, Jesse had hung up, called Josiah's store, and spoke to Ed Seeley. Seeley then called her back to tell her that she couldn't reach anyone at Josiah's home and that he was not at her in-laws either. She learned about the murders a while later when a neighbor came by and told her. She had also testified that she entered the home later in the day to retrieve family pictures for the press. When questioned about possible enemies of Josiah's, Jesse had nothing else to add. So she couldn't think of anyone that would want to harm her brother-in-law either. The fifth witness was Dr. Williams, who was the second physician to enter the home. And he was the first to actually physically examine the victims. So again, I'm not sure where in the hell all these doctors are coming from. Okay, because I had no idea about this doctor until I got this testimony. But I don't know. So it's clear that reporting and record keeping in the 1912s was not the best, because there's a lot of information that is in this one spot, but not in this record. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So this one was kind of hard to piece together because... So Williams testified that Ed Seeley had stopped him on the street the morning of June 10th and told him that a doctor was wanted at the Moore home for an examination. He went on to say that when he arrived at the house, that Dr. Cooper and another party who he believed to be Marshall Horton were coming out onto the porch. He stated Dr. Cooper and Horton re-entered the home with him. Williams went on to testify that upon entering the home, he smelled no odor, just like the previous doctor, and he saw nothing out of place. When asked to describe the position of the bodies, he went on to say that the bed in Joe and Sarah's room was facing to the east with their heads facing west. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Joe had been laying on the south side or the left side of the bed. He was laying on his back. His left hand was on his chest. Quote, the faces were all beaten in. Williams testified that Sarah had been laying beside Joe, so on the right side of the bed. He said, quote, at the left hand, east side of the room was a cot and another bed standing there with a little boy in it. He was sleeping on his stomach and top of his head all beaten in. There was a gauze undershirt on top of his head, soaked up with blood. I lifted it off to see which one it was, and it was Paul Moore. So the littlest, the baby of the family.
Aww.
So at some point, he had left the room that he was in with his brothers and went in to sleep on a little cot in his mom and dad's room. He then described discovering Catherine, quote, in the bed, angling at the foot of the bed, southeast corner of the room, was another bed with a little girl, and her head was all beaten in, and on top of her head was a little dress. It was all blood spattered, and I think it was partially curled up over her head. Finally, he discovered the older boys, Herman and Arthur. Quote, in the bed to the southwest corner of the room were two little boys lying with both tops of their heads beaten in and blood splattered on everything and blood over the pillows. When he entered the downstairs bedroom, William said he saw two girls. Quote, from their appearances, one was a big woman and a little girl. And that the girl out to the outside of the bed next to the east side, there were in, head facing to the north. She had evidently moved after being struck or had been moved. I'm so sorry if this is confusing for anybody else. It's just the way that they talk is just throwing me off so much.
Yeah.
He continued, quote, the blood was all scattered over the pillows. Apparently, she had been struck on the head, squirmed down in the bed, perhaps one third of the way. The left hand was thrown back, so it was sticking up below the pillow, and her head was all beaten in. I took particular attention to an axe wound, and that the edge had come out on the forehead, so I could see the sharp edge well in the top and side of the head. With the little girl, the back of her head was all beaten in. So at some point, the killer had flipped the axe around and had used the sharp end on her. Most likely because she had woke up and was trying to get away.
Probably, Tim said,
yeah, it's rough. Oh, man. Okay, so Williams had said he did not recognize either of the Cylinder girls. He just knew that there were two girls that did not belong to the Moore family. He did not recognize them. Ina, though, he said, quote, but she was so mutilated that I wasn't able to identify her at that time. He said Lena's head appeared to be covered with a small boy's gray coat. He noticed clothing on the floor, including underwear, and that their dresses were hanging on the wall or the foot of the bed, and neither had blood on them. When questioned about the possibility of a sexual assault on any of the victims, William responded to the negative, quote, I looked to see if there was any possible. Might have been attempted intercourse or rape or something, but I did not notice any. So it was made to look as if that's what was going on, but there was no evidence of any of that.
Huh.
So after testifying that he had found no footprints at the scene, Williams was excused. Next, we have Edward Landers. Edward Landers was the son of a neighbor. He was staying with his mother just right near the Moore house. So he testified that he had been spending the summer at his mother's home, just a few houses away. He said he had went to bed shortly after 9 p.m. on Sunday night. Shortly before he fell asleep, though, he said he heard a sound that, quote, impressed him. I'm not sure what that's supposed to mean, though. He said it sounded like, quote, like one boy hooting for another on the outside somewhere. According to Landers, the sound occurred at regular intervals, but he didn't connect it with anything and fell asleep shortly thereafter. I find that odd because no one else in the neighborhood heard anything. Out of all the people on that street, he's the only one that heard anything, and he's a few houses away from the Moore house. He's not even the closest neighbor. So I don't think, if he actually did hear this, I don't think it has anything to do with what happened. I think probably it's just not a coincidence.
Yeah.
Because the neighbors that were literally right next door didn't hear anything. So I think it's just a coincidence. If he actually heard anything, he could have just been trying to get himself, you know, and be a part of it.
Right.
So when pressed a little bit, Landers had settled on approximately 11 p.m. He further testified that although he didn't think of it at the time, the next morning when he heard about the murders, it had occurred to him that the noises may have been a woman moaning. But again, no one else heard it. So I'm not sure how, I'm not too confident in his testimony actually tying into it. So that they called Ross Moore. He was the first person to enter the house, as we know. Ross testified that at 8:15 Sunday morning, Mary Pickham had called him to ask about the health of his parents. She had already spoken to his wife, though. She remained concerned that the Moore house was so unusually quiet. Concerned, Ross said that he walked over to Joe's store and spoke with Ed Seeley, who also said that Joe hadn't been in yet, and that, yes, he too found it unusual. According to Ross, he then went over to the house and checked the barn to see if Joe's horse was still there. He and Peckham tried rapping on the windows and calling for someone, but the blinds were down and it prevented him from seeing inside the house. So he then used one of the spare keys to the house that he had had to open the door. Ross went on to say that he entered the parlor and noted that at first nothing looked out of place. It wasn't until he pushed open the door into the room off of the parlor that he saw blood on the sheets. He said, quote, did not wait long enough to see anything else. and returned outside and told Peckham to call the marshal. When questioned further, Ross could shed no light on any possible suspect, and he was excused. Following Ross, they called another one of Josiah's brothers, Fenwick Moore, which, let me just say, what kind of name? Like, that is one hell of a name, Fenwick.
It is.
That just tells you how old this case is. Like, Fenwick. I mean, I don't think I've ever heard that name. So, Fenwick lived in Red Oak rather than Villisca. Finn had also testified that he didn't know much about Joe's business affairs and that he had no idea who would have wanted him dead. They, of course, called town marshal Hank Horton. He spent very little time on the stand, though, which is odd to me because he was one of the first ones there, so you would think that he would be on the stand for a while.
Yeah.
Horton simply confirmed that he was approached by Seeley between 8:15 and 8:30 Monday morning, and he was asked to accompany him to the Moore home. Once there, he had entered the house with Seeley. Upon seeing the bodies, he stated that he immediately went to get Dr. Cooper and re-entered the house with Cooper and Dr. Hugh. Horton confirmed that there was no unusual odors, the blinds were down, and the bodies were covered. Then he was dismissed. So basically, he reiterated the same thing that everyone before him had. So next, they called John Lee Van Gilder. It's either Gilder or Gilder. This was Josiah's nephew, and they called Harry Moore, who was his brother. Although Van Gilder had admitted that he had spoken to Joe briefly on Sunday afternoon, he couldn't shed any light on the whereabouts of his father, who was Harry. Although Harry was questioned about Moyer and Van Gilder like his other brothers, he had almost no knowledge of Joe's business or personal affairs, and he didn't have anything to add that hadn't already been testified to. Following these witnesses that didn't really add much into the investigation, they called their 12th and 13th witnesses, who was Blanche and Joseph Stillinger. So Blanche was the eldest of the Stillinger children and the sister to the victims, Lena. Blanche said that Josiah had called her home about 6 p.m. Sunday night and asked to speak to her mother. When Blanche told him that her mother was outside, he went on to tell her that the girls were going to church with his family and he didn't want them walking back to their grandmother's home in the dark. So he asked if she thought if it would be okay for the girls to just spend the night. She told him that she didn't think that that would be a problem. So after a few other questions regarding her sister's ages, Blanche was excused. So their father, Joseph Stillinger, took her place. After questioning Mr. Stillinger about his hired help and whether or not he knew of anyone that could have committed this crime, the coroner asked if he had called the Moore house on Sunday morning. Quote, "My wife did, yes," he responded. When questioned about the time of the call, Stillinger replied, quote, "I remember she phoned about 3 different times trying to get someone in the house. I did not ask her about the particular time, but she expected the children back just before school." So after the Stillinger's testimony, they called their final and last witness, Charles Moore. Charles was another one of Joe's brothers. He's got a big family, let me tell you.
Apparently.
So he could not say that the axe was his brother's. He did know that Joe did keep a similar one in the coal shed, but he couldn't say, yes, that's definitely his. Charles had also testified that he believed it was a habit for Joe to lock up the house from the inside when they went to sleep. Quote, "I went there several mornings after the team to go in the country." I'm not sure what he's talking about, what he means when he says the team. I'm not sure what that means. Anyway, to go into the country, and of course, I always went to the dining room in the front, and they would not have left that door open. I would have to wait until someone came and opened the door, would lock the rest of the house on the inside and lock that door and keep the key inside. So according to Charles, when they would go to sleep, Mr. Moore would lock the house up. So he doesn't find it odd that the house was locked up. But everyone else says that it was odd and they never locked the house. So following the inquest, the bodies were released and a funeral was held. The Moore Stillinger funeral services were held in Villisca's town square on June 12, 1912. Thousands were in attendance that day. National Guardsmen blocked the streets as a hearse moved through them towards the firehouse. Their caskets were on display during the funeral like they normally are. They were carried on several wagons to the Villisca Cemetery where all eight were laid to rest. The funeral cortege was 50 carriages long. The inquest had ruled the case as an octuple murder, obviously. But who had killed the six members of the Moore family? And the two Stillinger girls, and why had they done it? That was what they still had to figure out.
Yeah.
So that is where I'm going to end part one. For part two, we will talk about the suspects that came into the case, and we'll dive into each one of those. We're going to talk about the theories surrounding the case. We'll talk about what each of us think and who we think did it. And then we're going to get into the haunting of the house.
Okay.
So that is it for this week. So make sure you come back 2 weeks for part two. And so, Ashley, if you don't have anything else to add.
Nope.
All right. I'm going to post some of the photos that I have on our Facebook page with our sources. You can find that in our description as always.
And please make sure you give us a rate and a review. Don't forget to subscribe so you can get notifications when our new episodes are released.
We hope you keep listening and remember to
watch for monsters
and don't kill people. Bye, y'all.
Bye.